face mask when I eat. I wear my face mask when I sleep. I wear my face mask. I can't breathe. That's the Media Bear there, and their song "I Wear My Face Mask in the Car" from this year, 2020. It's welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Well, it's actually not BCFM's Politics Show anymore, is it? It's not the BCFM Politics Show, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, slowly but surely migrating to become the PRSC Politics Show, the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. This week, as many of us suspected, our station manager Pat Hart from BCFM had different ideas to us about how to cover local, national and international affairs. And a BCFM Politics Show doppelganger has appeared on our old station, BCFM. It's called the Bristol Agenda, and it's on every Monday. So we'll be having a listen to their coverage of the Beirut explosion this week and also the unrest in Belarus. Is it an improvement on this programme? Or just a watered-down version of mainstream media propaganda? Surely not. And Joe Biden accepts the US Democratic Party nomination as a virtual convention, which seems designed to stifle dissent and make it look as if the party members approve of everything that's going on. Not a very democratic way to do things, even though it's called the Democratic Party. And also the World Economic Forum and Prince Charles prepare the Great Reset, when the international banksters crash the global economy and try to blame it on COVID or a war or Brexit. This week we hear from the man who will lead us into the brave new Great Reset world. It'll be fascinating to see what Martin makes of him. Klaus Schwab from the annual Davos conference. And two documentaries out this week. Coup 53, the untold story of the 1953 CIA and MI6 led coup against Iran's Prime Minister Mossadegh, as well as another film, Plandemic 2, which looks at the 2020 June, July and August, will it ever end, censorship epidemic spreading across the world just as the pandemic runs out of steam. Finally, another of my YouTube films was censored this week, a 1989 ABC Australian 60 Minutes documentary about Satanism and ritual abuse in the UK, also murder and child sacrifice. So that came at 1989, didn't it? And as we've heard many times on this programme, in the early 1990s, right the way through to 2000, slowly but surely, the broadcast investigative journalists right across Britain were shut down. But that was before all that, and over in Australia in 1989. But I think maybe we better start this week, Martin, with the news that was kind of just breaking as we were on air last week, about these three Iranian tankers that have been seized, apparently, and disappeared off the radar on their way to Venezuela. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I understand the Iranians have made a statement saying that by the time these tankers were impounded by the US, they'd already been sold on to somebody else, and they weren't, in fact, the contents were not Iranian anymore, and that none of the ships were Iranian flagged. So that's all I've managed to pick up in relation to this. I heard that the tankers had all been taken to Houston in Texas. And I mean, I suppose the background to all of this is the ongoing attempts to overthrow the government of Venezuela and provoke the government of Iran.
I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it? It almost seems as if potentially anyway, I mean, I'm just guessing here like you are, but the Iranian government might have done this as a kind of sting operation, saying we're sending these tankers over to Venezuela and waiting for the US to pounce on them.
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, we know that lots of bomb attacks and fires have been going on in Iran.
Martin, why would they have sold them on to somebody else in that case?
I do not know, Tony. I'm just saying what they have said.
They wanted to leave the Americans with something which is actually not Iranian at all, and so they've seized them pointlessly. I think that's what's going on. I think we're dealing with quite a sassy, smart Iranian regime that knows what the Americans are up to before they even do it.
Well, we're dealing with an ongoing low-level war. So, for example, there have been various attacks inside Iran on various facilities, which we hardly hear about, but the Israelis are virtually boasting that they're behind all of that. In Iraq, there have been various mortar attacks on US positions, which are not designed to kill, but just in time to remind them that it's time for them to go home. So we're basically we're bowling towards a potential war here. But the Iranians, of course, have got an interest in holding back until after the November election in the US, because they've got hopes that they might be able to get a better deal from Biden than from Trump and the Israelis. But nevertheless, at some point, the whole thing's going to boil over.
Anyway, I thought, so it's interesting dealing with that one. But there's also this week, the Mali coup, the troops there planning a transitional government. What do you make of that one?
Well, I must admit, I haven't looked closely into what's going on in Mali. But, as AFRICOM and the French have been sticking their finger into affairs in that part of the world for a very long time.
It's very much like it's Syria, isn't it? The old French colonialists have come back, because that was a French colony too.
It was, and I believe they've got both French and American forces deployed on the ground there, no doubt with British liaison officers tagging along. And, you've got a so-called Islamist insurgency, which allows this to happen. And, of course, as we were talking earlier, a lot of Islamist insurgencies are actually run by the West. And then they say, oh, look, there's an Islamist insurgency. You need our help. We need,
exactly.
We need protection.
Exactly. This is pretty cynical stuff, isn't it? I mean, really, it's just a resurgence of the old colonial powers. France says its military operation Barkhane will continue in Mali, according to Reuters. This week, France will pursue its military operations in Mali against Islamic fighters despite the ousting of the country's president by a coup. The French Armed Forces Minister said on Thursday the Barkhane operation, asked for by the Mali population and authorised by the UN Security Council, continues. Florence Parly said on Twitter, and this is an anti-Islamic operation, Martin. Exactly kind of the sort of thing that seems to be the trigger to bring about Western and UN intervention in a country.
Well, if you think about the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime in Libya, what that led to was massive destabilization of countries to the south of Libya. Mali would be included in that, and then provides an excuse for further interventions to deal with the mess caused by the first intervention. And of course, that the cynical analysis of that is Islamist terrorists of a Salafi orientation are deeply, fundamentally implicated in relationships with Western military intelligence. Have been since the 1980s, an operation, the operation that they ran at that time. And then, of course, they then say,
so, you're talking about Cyclone?
Cyclone, yeah. So, in other words, this goes back a very long way. I mean, everybody knows that the Islamist opposition in Afghanistan was funded and trained by Western intelligence services and military back in the 80s.
But, I mean, the obvious question
the story is that they supposedly then set off to do their own thing, but they don't.
Martin, the obvious question has got to be, was there really any independence for these African countries after the colonialism was started stripping away to?
No. I mean, as Kwame Nkrumah, the leader of Ghana, pointed out years ago, he coined the phrase neo-colonialism.
Well, we seem to have lost Martin there.
Hello.
We've got another article here looking at another subject. So let's see if we can get Martin. Are you coming? Yeah. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
Sorry, we just lost you there. You said what you said was no. Can you just carry on from that point?
Well, the neo-colonialism basically countries like Mali are in debt to the international banking system. They've got no real freedom of manoeuvre on paper, supposedly an independent country. In praxis, not the case.
Yeah, but countries like Britain are in debt to the international banking system too, and the United States even more.
Well, yes, but they've got more resources with which to be. I mean, basically, there's a hierarchy of power, isn't there? And we know who's on the top of it and who's on the bottom of it. And of course, the ordinary people in the US and Britain don't have much of a say, but we've got more of a say than the poor people in Mali.
Well, let's see how the ordinary people in Bradwell, I see about that they get much of a say in that reactor that's taking there. Now the planning rules are all being torn up. Anyway, look, the next story to look at this week is in Iran, Trump is attempting to sanction Iran, but it's sparking outrage. That's at least according to USA News, MSN.com. Several countries expressed outrage on Thursday at President Donald Trump's demand UN Security Council reimpose devastating sanctions against Iran for violating a 2015 nuclear agreement, even though the Trump administration walked away from the deal. So this is a bit of a complicated one. Even though the US have abandoned the deal 2 years ago, or even is it 3 years ago, I think, they're still trying to invoke various clauses in the deal to... I think is it called the kickback clause in the deal?
Yeah, well, it's an arms embargo that's the key to this, and of course it's been knocked down by the UN.
Sorry, snapback.
Yeah, well, I mean the UN system has basically said no, you can't do this. If you're not in this deal, you can't invoke parts of the deal to impose sanctions on Iran. And but of course what the US does is it says we can do whatever we like. And if you do deals with Iran or any arms deals or whatever, we're going to put sanctions on you. But of course, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are quite prepared to do arms deals with Iran if necessary. And Trump will then put sanctions on them.
They really seem to be almost fevered here, the Americans. What they're doing is almost unhinged. They're not even in this deal anymore. And yet there they are trying to tell everyone else that's in it that they're invoking X and Y clause. The US cannot trigger snapback mechanisms after its withdrawal from the JCPOA. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said in a tweet, using the abbreviation for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the formal name for the Iran nuclear deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, back in the Obama administration, there was a kind of, you know, a general agreement that they could have a they could have civilian nuclear power. They'd have to accept lots of intrusive inspections, but on that basis, they could be welcomed back into the international community as a country in good standing. And of course, Trump cancelled that as soon as he came to power, to the great delight of the Israelis. But they're still stamping their feet and demanding that everybody do as they say, even though there's no agreement by others for what they want to do. But what they're doing is they're using US law as if it was international law. They won't accept international law. They're not part of the law of the sea. They're not part of the International Criminal Court. They basically don't get involved in anything where they think that they're going to be told what to do. But they then insist that everybody else has to fulfill US law. So Peter Singer is a vulture capitalist, and he's able to use a New York court to force Argentina to pay 100% of its dubious debts, even though they've already agreed with the debtors that they're not going to do that. So we've got the US. They used to say about the USSR that the frightening thing about the USSR, it was a country that didn't have any borders, that it could actually become the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, could become the whole world. And that was the real danger of the Soviet Union. But of course, the US insists that its laws, which are, you know, are basically under the thumb of the special interests inside the US, are superior to international law. That is their position. And of course, lots of small countries may disagree with that, but they can make life very difficult for them. If they do, they're sanctioning everybody who's involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, for example. The German government aren't happy about it, but that's what they're trying to do. They're chucking
away. The other big development this week is the deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, which may come as a surprise to some, but not to this show. We were only a couple of weeks ago, we heard from the Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gatacheva that the UAE was involved in the supply of arms, mostly Eastern European arms, paid for by the United States to Al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and ISIS in the Syrian so-called civil war, which is quite obvious. The Gulf states, plus the Israelis and the Americans and NATO countries, were all funding proxy armies to try and overthrow President Assad in Syria as part of a regime change exercise. So what do you make of this deal now out in the public and in the open between UAE and Israel, Martin?
Well, I think what's really going to happen is that Saudis are going to follow suit and recognise Israel. And of course, this is being presented to the know-nothing US public as there are moderate Arabs who want to make peace with Israel, and then there are the naughty Palestinians who just won't accept that they can't have what they want. But of course, who voted for the leaders in the UAE? Who voted for the leaders in Saudi Arabia? Both countries are basically creations of British intelligence at the end of the First World War. And, of course, they are the home of funding for Salafi terrorism around the world. And after 9/11, you'd have thought we might have invaded them, but we didn't. We invaded Afghanistan.
Well, look, another spin-off of all of this is that, and it may have been one of the things that induced the UAE to sign this deal. If you look at these look at the sort of logic bit, what might be behind it as things happen at the same time. Why did they do this? Well, Trump apparently is now saying, well, we're going to sell the F-35 to UAE, although the Israelis don't want him to. So this is this new so-called amazing jet fighter bomber, which is nothing of the sort, really. It's all extremely problematic and extremely expensive. And it won't really be able to deal, it doesn't look like, with the Russians in the air. It looks great on paper, the F-35. But anyway, the UAE wants it, Martin, and the Israelis don't want them to have it. And it looks like they're going to get it.
Well, I'm not quite sure how that's going to be squared off. What the Israelis agreed was that they wouldn't annex the West Bank yet. Netanyahu has already told his domestic audience that we will annex the West Bank. But in order to get this recognition from the UAE, we've agreed with the Americans not to do it yet. But as far as I'm concerned, we are going to do it eventually. And Trump is trying to finesse a situation where he can say that he's done something in international affairs before the election in November, where he's achieved something, you know, and one of his aides even suggested that this deal should allow him to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, would you believe? But it's basically amongst thieves to carry on stealing.
Well, in the background of all of this, we've got the embattled Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So thousands this week, again on the Sabbath day, returned to the streets in Israel, urging him to resign. Protesters clashed with police outside the residence of the embattled Prime Minister, who's facing corruption allegations. Thousands of demonstrators returned to the streets of Jerusalem, calling for the resignation and his corruption allegations and mishandling of the coronavirus pandemic. Is that why they're out there? Images from news agencies and social media showed demonstrators being dragged by police as anti-Netanyahu protests continue for the eighth week in a row. Some of the protesters attempted to march towards the residence, but were prevented by police. Haaretz estimated around 50,000 Israelis protested across the country on Saturday. These demonstrations are enormous, Martin. I've seen nothing apart from maybe 2 months ago, a little blip on the news here about it. But we're talking about tens of thousands of Israelis coming out on the streets saying, we've had enough of this guy Netanyahu, get rid of him. So there's a lot of pressure on the man at the moment.
Yeah, and of course it's dangerous because he may do something silly in order to divert from this pressure. And, he may already have done some very dangerous things.
You mean like Beirut port by chance?
Well, that's what I was hinting.
Yes. Well, anyway, so that's all for that, international coverage for a minute. But I thought what we'd do is we would, and that's my little segue into it, we would have a listen to new programme which has popped up on BCFM to replace us. Obviously, at the great wisdom of our managing editor and station manager and chief executive of the BCFM charity, Patrick Hart, who's also very close to the Bristol mayor, Marvin Rees. Actually, their friendship goes back many years. Anyway, so we'll be looking now at that new programme that's come out. It's called The Bristol Agenda. And so we'll have a listen now to their take on the Beirut attack that we've just been talking about. How did they deal with it? And then, Martin, maybe you can comment on what you make of their analysis.
The Bristol Agenda on BCFM.
Good afternoon, Bristol. Thank you for tuning in to The Bristol Agenda, a news and current affairs show where we let Bristol set the agenda. Today in the studio with me is our man Tim Hinson, looking very sun-kissed, back from holiday.
Afternoon, how you doing? Got my vitamin D coursing through my veins.
Where have you been, Tim? You look very fresh and healthy.
Oh, I went on an exotic trip to Abu Dhabi in Mid Wales.
Ooh, lovely. Lots of swimming, sunbathing?
A lot of swimming, a lot of sunbathing.
Very nice. And sadly, we are still missing Sassandra today. Hopefully, she'll be back soon. But instead, we have Luke Barber, Bristolian, fellow journalist, and my old schoolmate. How you doing, Luke?
Hello, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you for joining us here.
Take it away, Priyanka, please.
Okay, so for our next topic, we want to talk about Beirut, where sadly there was a bomb blast earlier this month, which killed up to 135 people with thousands injured. It's a pretty devastating blast, especially seeing as news reports are coming out now saying that it definitely could have been avoided. So the blast was caused by an explosion of, what was it, 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate that was stored in Beirut's port. Apparently, security officials had warned the Prime Minister and the President months before, saying that it could pose a security risk and destroy the capital. That's according to Reuters and other news sources. So I think the fact that they didn't act, and that a lot of people are blaming this explosion on government negligence, which already is as seen by the protests that were happening in Beirut a while back, is something that is a strong feeling in the city. I actually used to live in Beirut for a few years ago. It's a small, very vibrant city, I think one which is still reeling from the effects of a civil war that raged on for years. It's still very much trying to rebuild, and you know, I think there was always this interesting sense in Lebanon of, you know, living for today in case you die tomorrow. And I think when things like this happen, it shows you that this isn't just a cliche, but like a lived reality, sadly. So, yes, Luke, next steps for the story.
Well, it sort of coincides with the sort of rather unfortunate a verdict in the UN-backed tribunal into the assassination of the former leader Rafiq al-Hariri, who was killed in a massive bomb blast over 15 years ago now in Beirut. So a verdict is expected in that case. Four members of the Iran-backed Shiite group Hezbollah have been on trial in absentia over the killing of Saudi-backed Hariri and Lebanon's main Sunni Muslim leader. Hezbollah does deny any role in the killing, which set the stage for years of confrontation, culminating in a brief civil war, I believe, in 2008. Mm. But, you know, this verdict is really coming at a time when new divisions are emerging over demands for an international quiet inquiry and political accountability for the port blast. So it's a sort of a bit of a political milieu, a melange of all sorts of major things.
Yes, so Martin, what do you make of that? And a little bit of analysis of the bomb. Although they called it a bomb, they then went on to say it was actually an explosion of something in the ammonium nitrate in the warehouse. And also they're discussing in quite a bit of depth there the assassination of Hariri.
Yeah, well, of course, we've got the verdict from the International Tribunal, and Hezbollah are exonerated, although some member of Hezbollah, one member, was blamed. But, of course, at the time, Nasrullah gave a press conference where he showed that an Israeli drone had been in the area where Rafiq al-Hariri was the day he died. And that he were able to show that because they'd actually hacked into the drone and they showed the drones for 2 hours, the drone flying over the area where this happened. Inside Lebanon itself, there's definitely different views about who did it. In actual fact, if as Hezbollah believe, Rafiq Hariri, the pro-Saudi father of the current Rafiq Hariri, was murdered by the Israelis, then, of course, what it led to was a brief civil war, as the gentleman said, which then led to the Syrians being booted out of Lebanon. So it makes it very unlikely that the Syrians and Hezbollah would have done it, because it led immediately to a negative political outcome for them. Now, people would say, well, they wouldn't be. This is all very complicated. But as you say, they're using Reuters there. They're basically coming out with a general pro-Western point of view about what's going on there.
So,
no real analysis, is
well,
there?
Well, no, what we're getting is a kind of cut and pasting of, the news wire services and what they're saying. Whereas, that, I'm afraid, our analysis, which is a little bit deeper than that. And also what we're doing is that we are showing the great big fat holes in these stories. They're not doing that at all now. Now, I imagine that it would be interesting now, I think, to listen to. Oh, yeah. What about the 2008 civil war they were talking about there, Martin?
Well, the killing of Rafiq Hariri led to a situation where Syria was forced to withdraw from Lebanon, which of course gave, which means that they probably had no motive for killing Hariri. And of course, the son of Rafiq Hariri went to Saudi Arabia not long ago and was kidnapped by Mohammed bin Salman because they're trying. I mean, basically, and there are nothing mentioned there about ongoing sanctions on Libya by the US.
You mean Lebanon?
In order to try and force Hezbollah out of office, which has led to a collapse of the Lebanese currency and made major problems and unrest.
I mean, at the end of course, the day,
that is that the West is presenting this as the problem here is the incompetent government of Lebanon who need to be removed and a series of technocrats need to be brought
missing,
in so that the IMF can do X, Y, and Z. You know,
entirely missing from their analysis is the juxtaposition with this whole situation we were just talking about in Israel with a beleaguered President Netanyahu, who in the past, certainly back in the mid-1990s, has used false flag bomb attacks in his own country in order to try and blame the opposition and ride to power on the wave of bus bombings and this sort of thing. He's done that. And also, you know, many would say that his faction was very closely connected with the assassination of the great peacemaker Rabin at the same time. And then as part of all of this, we know that the Israelis would rather, and in fact, the Hezbollah would beat them if they had a shooting war with actual armies of the Israelis going into Lebanon. And so they're wanting to use psychological warfare, that is media hypnosis, conning people using the media, and also economic warfare to bring the country to its knees. And this attack, as it seems it is, on the port there in Lebanon, the explosion of a bomb, which, I mean, you know, it's basic stuff to do with ballistics. If you set fire to a warehouse full of ammonium nitrate, it does not deliver the sort of pressure wave that we saw, massive pressure wave, which is a fuel air bomb. In fact, you know, we were discussing last week, weren't we, the American professor who teaches in Israeli universities, that he actually suggested 3 or 4 years ago that a fuel air bomb in Beirut would be a great idea because it would destroy all the areas where Hezbollah were hiding their weapons. We had none of that analysis at all.
No, well, Hezbollah denied that they were storing weapons at the port, and I tend to believe them because the port is actually controlled by Rafiq Hariri's people. So if they're going to be doing people for corruption and incompetence, then they're in the firing line. But underlying all of this, of course, back at Lebanon in the 1970s, the Israelis engaged in all kinds of bomb attacks in order to create a civil war. That was in their interest, and that's what they did. But of course, what you're dealing with there, what we just heard, is what you might call, as you say, cut and paste from the mainstream stuff. And you've got the lady there saying, well, I used to live in Beirut, which is fine, but it doesn't mean you know anything about it. And, it's just basically regurgitating the general stuff that's floating around in the mainstream media.
Kind of almost like sort of school student union bar chat, really, rather than analysis.
Yeah, I mean, none of it was, you know, it's legitimate opinion, but it's not very incisive.
Well,
analysis there.
All I'd say, Martin, is it's not journalism, which is showing both sides of what's going on, at least attempting to, at least balancing out the massive, massive power of the mainstream press and these wire services to influence opinion. So a bit of the backstory. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to our final clip from the Bristol Agenda show this week. I don't think we're going to do this anymore. I just thought it'd be interesting to dip in and see what our managing editor, Pat Hart, has seen fit to replace us with. And this is the BCFM clip of the Bristol Agenda about Belarus. So there's a subject that you know a bit about, Martin. I think we'll hear from you after this.
So I'll maybe go over to you on this, Luke. Have you ever visited this part of the world?
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately not. I know people who have.
The Minsk Tractor Factory?
The Minsk Tractor Factory. No, but I hear really good things. it's in the Lonely Planet, I believe. I haven't been to Belarus. I know people who have say it's an interesting place. Very much one that is, felt like a sort of extension of Russia in many ways, sort of in the way that some parts of Ukraine, many people felt Russian, a lot of Belarusians, particularly Mr. Lukashenko himself, are particularly Russian-aligned.
Well, yeah, so it was previously part of the USSR, and as I say, it has strong sort of trading links and everything with Russia at the moment. I think there's always a danger when we sort of cover stories like this that we can sort of focus too much on the sort of international context here, because I was reading up on this, so trying to sort of get an angle on it and, you know, work out who the good guys are, who the bad guys, and you can immediately sort of skip over to, oh, it's Putin's man, or, you know, this is the EU, have this interest there. And I mean, as far as I can tell, this does seem to be a pretty sort of straightforward sort of dispute about the sort of mechanics of running basic democratic legitimacy. So the opposition candidate, Svetlana Chinkuaye, has, before she ran for president, it was actually her husband that was running, but he has been sort of detained and forced out of the country, and now the sort of all the sort of different opposition parties, so right from the sort of Christian Democrat side of things, so quite a conservative party, through to the sort of Social Democratic Party and the sort of socialist parties, have all sort of backed her. So yeah, it's interesting to consider that sort of authoritarian context.
So, as a world-renowned, we could almost say that, since you're on Russia Today, Eastern European expert, Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, they obviously don't know very much about Belarus, is sort of the obvious thing to say. I mean, the woman that claims she won the election is called Tikhanovskaya. He didn't obviously manage to do enough research to get the name right. And, of course, it's again a rehashing of the mainstream analysis of what's going on there. Most of the Western media refuse to understand that Lukashenko, whatever you may think of him, has won 5 elections. This is the 6th one that he's won. You could say, well, that can't be right. That's ridiculous. But on the other hand, to do that, you have to have some political support. They mentioned there the factories, the Minsk tractor factory. You've got 5 big factories in the urban areas in Belarus, all of which are still state-owned. And one of the reasons why Lukashenko has been so successful politically over many years is that when the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s, Belarus got independence, handed it to on a plate. They decided that they didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union anymore, unlike some other countries like Ukraine. And so they became independent. And what Lukashenko did, he used to run a collective farm. So he was a collective farm boss. And they didn't decollectivize the farms, and they didn't privatize the factories. And as we speak today, they've got nearly full employment in Belarus, which is very different from the situation in Ukraine or in the Baltic states or even in Poland, which are the pro-Western countries surrounding it. And there was talk of this week of strikes within the tractor factory. Some people went on strike, but lots of others didn't. The way that was presented in the Western media was the others are too scared to go on strike. But it may well be the case that the people who work in these factories voted for Lukashenko because he's going to keep the factories in the state control and he's not going to sack everybody. If Tikhanovskaya and her backers come to power, which is not clear because she may have got more than 10% of the vote, but I don't think she won. Nobody serious thinks she won the election. But if they came to power, the first thing they would do is say to Western companies, come and buy these factories and sack everybody. And that's the reason why Lukashenko stayed in power. He's basically in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union, or rather Russia, under Yeltsin, had decided to open the market up under pressure from the West, which led to mass unemployment, 1,000% inflation, all sorts of problems for ordinary people. Belarus basically stayed out of it. It's a backwater, and it's still a backwater. And because that's very annoying to the sort of go-ahead young people who are the leaders of these demonstrations, many of whom are actually being paid by Western non-governmental organisations. There's no point denying that. Doesn't mean they're wrong, but you've got to be honest about it.
Okay, Martin. Well, that's what we call analysis, not just sort of talking around the subject, making it rather clear to your audience that you don't really know what you're talking about.
Well, I've never visited Belarus, but I used to go to the Baltic states a lot. And let me just make a comparison with the Baltic states. Lithuania, where Tikhanovskaya has gone now, what happened is they joined the EU, they joined the euro, and in actual fact, their local industry, they decollectivized the farms. I've seen the consequences of that in Lithuania. It was the mafia took over. They gave lots of little people in Myshagla outside. I was in Myshagla outside Vilnius in the 90s. And they gave all these people had been given a little bit of land, but they couldn't make anything of it. And they basically had to sell their milk to the mafia, who then sold it on in Vilnius at hundreds of percent markup. And of course, there used to be a kind of central area in the collective farm where people would gather, you know, a communal hall and all the rest of it. They put a padlock on the collective hall, and we had to meet these farmers in the church hall of the church. And because there was no other physical space, and the mafia was standing at the back while we were discussing with them. And then they then threatened me in Vilnius afterwards. But the point is that most people, I've not been in Belarus, but I was an expert on Eastern Europe for 10 years. I worked for the New Economics Foundation. Then was the East European desk officer for the Catholic Fund of Overseas Development. And these people who are claimed to be talking about this, basically their level of knowledge about it is minimal. That's what I'd say.
You said just then that nobody can really say that she won or that he lost because of the overwhelming vote. Apparently, though, this week we hear from Al Jazeera and other people that the European Union has rejected the Belarus vote result and its warning of imminent new sanctions.
Yes. What happened earlier in the year was that Lukashenko started to talk to the West about what they would like to happen. And the Pompeo visited Minsk, and the United States opened an embassy in March after years of hostility. But then, of course, the election happened. Lukashenko won as usual. And then the West decided they were going to, or the locals decided that they weren't happy with it. Some of them got beaten up by the police. I mean, Lukashenko basically kept all of the good and bad aspects of the Soviet Union going. So he kept everybody in work. He didn't allow the collective farms to be broken up. He made sure everybody was looked after in the way that they used to be. And that's quite popular. But at the same time, he was pretty nasty to those who stepped out of line. He was paranoid, authoritarian, etc. When you've got a country like Britain where, basically Boris Johnson didn't win the election. If you count the votes, if they were counted in the same way as they're counted in Belarus and in other European countries, Boris Johnson wouldn't be the prime minister of our country. Maybe we should go to the streets and demand a re-vote under a different system. Of course, that's probably what is going to happen in Scotland.
Belarusians will never accept the current leadership, says Tikhanovskaya from exile.
Yeah, well, it may be that what will happen, and I'll discuss this on RT on Sunday, is that some deal will be done whereby an election will be rerun. But the question is, if the election's rerun and Tikhanovskaya loses, are her backers going to accept the result? Because if they're not, there's not much point having another election, is there?
It does, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit reminiscent of Venezuela, this, isn't it?
It is, yes. She is basically being put forward as the Guaido of Belarus. Incidentally, Guaido, this week and last week, he's been photographed loads of times with these Colombian paramilitaries who were involved in drug dealing. And of course, he never stood for a president of Venezuela, and his support inside Venezuela is minimal. But he's been presented by the West, including Britain, as the president of Venezuela, which is why they've not been allowed to have their gold back, which is in the inside the Bank of England. It's the usual stuff. There's even more. I could go on. There's more complicated aspects to this because Russian mercenaries from Wagner were arrested by Lukashenko's people last week before the election, because they've been tipped off by the Ukrainians that they were there to subvert him after he'd been elected. So Lukashenko has been working on the assumption, he was talking to Pompeo, that he was going to be re-elected and he was going to start being nicer to the West, because he wanted, you know, to find out what they wanted. What do you want me to do? He was trying to move away from the Russian control. But of course, all he's done is ended up confronting a colour revolution.
Martin, Lukashenko is surrounded on 3 out of 4 sides by the Western powers. Is he going to survive?
Well, I think ultimately he probably will survive this, because there's no way anybody can force him to have another election. They just can't. And he's brazened it out this far, so he's just going to brazen it out, isn't he?
Martin, what about these protests? Well, look what happened in Ukraine.
Yeah, but what happened in Ukraine was ultimately the Maidan protesters were all in the Maidan Square, and then loads of them were shot, 80 of them shot through the head, and several police officers all at once. And what happened subsequently is we've had a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police were completely exonerated, because those snipers that had actually carried out the attack admitted they'd carried it out on a video link from Georgia. They'd all been brought
in. Martin, the Western powers don't really care about that, because they've now got control of the country and the media is hardly reporting what you're just saying.
Yes, but this is the point, is that NATO intelligence services are false flag terrorists, and they will kill pro-EU demonstrators to make a government look bad. And then they'll. What happened at the Odessa Trade Union Hall was that football hooligans and other criminals killed loads of new regime protesters. The Belarus has been a bit of a backwater, and I spoke to a Russian woman who was on a course I was on in Bristol not long ago, and I said to her, what she thought. She said, "Well, my dad, I've just come back from there with my kids. My dad used to be in the military in Russia, and he votes for Lukashenko because he doesn't want the sort of things we've seen in Ukraine." And of course, if you look north to the Baltic states, the young people in the Baltic states, the kind of people that are protesting in Belarus, they've all had to leave because there's no work for them at all at home, which is why they've all had to go west to get any kind of future. And that's the future for Belarus if Tikhanovskaya wins. But of course, the Russians will not like that if she came to power, because she's openly saying we want to join the EU and you want to join NATO. I don't think that's at all popular in Russia, in Belarus.
OK,
we're just hearing a very, very, do you know what I mean? There's a lot of things to say about it. I think ultimately what will happen is some kind of deal will be done.
But maybe not because we're
all about to go to war.
The
Russians will take over Belarus just like that if there's a war.
As an aside to what you're saying there, Martin, I think Belarus sounds like a very interesting country, and it may be actually a good time to visit it before it falls like Ukraine does.
Well, I think it was an interesting country because it was such a backwater. And of course, they've always disliked Lukashenko's position that he doesn't. I mean, he was popular inside the country because he didn't do the things the West wanted him to do. And basically, it's been quite successful.
Lukashenko, in Eastern Europe, Lukashenko is like last man standing.
He was only able to do that, though, Tony, because the Russians sold him energy at a fraction of world market prices. So if the regime changes, they will have to buy gas and oil from Russia at world market prices, which will then make the whole of Belarusian industry unviable. So a lot of these people
are
walking into a disaster.
It's a mostly rural country anyway.
Not entirely. You've got big state factories. And the tractor factory is an obvious one because that's linked into the rural economy. Yeah. But there's only about 9 million people in the country. So it was actually one of those places which kind of escaped from all the chaos around it, but not anymore.
Well, you seem to be saying he's going to tough it out and we're not going to see a Ukraine there.
No, because there you haven't got the same right-wing forces in Belarus that you've got in Ukraine.
Who are the Nazis, Martin.
Yeah.
Martin, those right-wing forces in Ukraine are Nazis. They're not neo-Nazis.
You haven't really got any Nazi forces in Belarus because it's like, you know, I understand that Belarusian and Russian are pretty much the same thing. You know, they can understand each other. And, of course, what's been missing from all the analysis in the West about this is how has Lukashenko stayed in power for 26 years? He's just brainwashed them all. He's bribed them. Well, he has bribed them. What he's done is he's not. If they followed the Western model, most of these people in these factories would all have been sacked years ago.
Okay.
They only have to look to the north to see what happens when you do that. Latvia, they've lost all of the younger generation have gone. You've just got old people living on pensions.
All right. So let's go to the States now. Joe Biden is giving his acceptance speech this week. I mean, it's a great long speech. All sorts of stuff about, you know, various aspects of his campaign. But I just thought let's get a snatch of this because, I mean, listening to it, I just thought this stuff is really wooden. It would never go down well in a European election. Maybe it's just that the United States is the only place where this stuff can still be said and taken seriously. So let's have a listen now to the tail end of his acceptance speech yesterday.
The Irish poet Seamus Heaney once wrote, "History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. This is our moment to make hope and history rhyme. With passion and purpose, let us begin, you and I together, one nation, under God, united in our love for America, united in our love for each other. For love is more powerful than hate. Hope is more powerful than fear. And light is more powerful than dark. This is our moment. This is our mission. May history be able to say that the end of this chapter of American darkness began here tonight as love and hope and light join in the battle for the soul of the nation. And this is a battle we will win and we'll do it together. I promise you. Thank you, and may God bless you, and may God protect our troops. Good night."
Well, no big round of applause at the end, because the whole thing was done in virtual reality somewhere. But Martin, he's just saying basically, the tenet of his speech is, Trump is darkness, I am the man of light.
Yeah, well, it's pretty basic, isn't it? What can you say? As you say, it's boilerplate rhetoric. It's not even particularly convincing because he sounds as if he's on his last legs. And of course, everybody knows that, you know, if you ask him a question, he can't understand what you're saying to him.
Apparently, he doesn't function very well without an auto cue in front of him.
Well, you know, he's probably getting to the stage where he can't even read the auto cue. I know Trump, whatever else you may say about him, has got the gift of the gab. That's also a bit of a problem because he says loads of stuff just off the top of his head.
It's a bit irritating, isn't it, that the way that the Democratic Party, last time they put Hillary Clinton in charge, he was extremely unpopular, and this time they put Biden in charge. It's almost like they don't want to win. They're really trying to do their best to lose.
Well, what they don't want is a progressive agenda. The whole purpose, don't forget that politics in the US is about money. You can't stand for any kind of office unless you are a millionaire or you know billionaires. And therefore, anybody else coming from the outside of the system, like Bernie Sanders or Tulsi Gabbard, they can't get any traction because they can't attract donors.
Well, that's lovely that you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard because we're going to hear from her now. And here she is taking on a few months ago, taking on Kamala Harris. And this is the running mate for Joe Biden, his vice presidential running mate for the Democratic Party in November's presidential elections, Kamala Harris. And Tulsi Gabbard, why was it that she never really made it through, Martin?
Well, she only stood in order to make her points about war. She knew she wasn't going to win, but she did it because she wanted to make her points about the endless wars of the US
she
government.
Did a very good job of that, but she also did a lot of research on Kamala Harris, and here she is talking about her record as a criminal prosecutor in the state of California.
Congresswoman Gabbard, you took issue with Senator Harris confronting Vice President Biden at the last debate. You called it a, quote, false accusation that Joe Biden is a racist. What's your response?
I want to bring the conversation back to the broken criminal justice system that is disproportionately negatively impacting black and brown people all across this country today. Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president, but I'm deeply concerned about this record. There are too many examples to cite, but she put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana. She blocked evidence that would have freed an innocent man from death row until the courts forced her to do so. She kept people in prison beyond their sentences to use them as cheap labor for the state of California. And she fought to keep cash bail system in place that impacts poor people in the worst kind of way.
Thank you, Congresswoman. Senator Harris, your response.
As the elected Attorney General of California, I did the work of significantly reforming the criminal justice system of a state of 40 million people, which became a national model for the work that needs to be done. And I am proud of that work. And I am proud of making a decision to not just give fancy speeches or be in a legislative body and give speeches on the floor, but actually doing the work of being in the position to use the power that I had to reform a system that is badly in need of reform. That is why we created initiatives that were about reentering former offenders and getting them counseling. Because I know that criminal justice system is so broken, that I am an advocate for what we need to do to not only decriminalize, but legalize marijuana in the United States.
I want to bring Congresswoman Gabbard back in. Your response,
please. The bottom line is, Senator Harris, when you were in a position to make a difference and an impact in these people's lives, you did not. And worse yet, in the case of those who were on death row, innocent people, you actually blocked evidence from being revealed that would have freed them until you were forced to do so. There is no excuse for that. And the people who suffered under your reign as prosecutor, you owe them an apology.
Senator Harris.
My entire career, I have been personally opposed to the death penalty, and that has never changed. And I dare anybody who is in a position to make that decision to face the people I have faced to say, I will not seek the death penalty. That is my background. That is my work. I am proud of it. I think you can judge people by when they are under fire, and it's not about some fancy opinion on a stage, but when they're in the position to actually make a decision, what do they do? When I was in the position of having to decide whether or not to seek a death penalty on cases I prosecuted, I made a very difficult decision that was not popular to not seek the death penalty. History shows that, and I am proud of those decisions.
Senator Harris, thank you very much.
Well, that's the reason we're looking at Kamala Harris, Martin, is because really Biden is not going to be in charge, is he? It's going to be her, really.
Well, provided Biden wins.
Well, obviously, yeah, but I mean, she is the main, you know, the main of the two, the main one of the
yeah,
two.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, they're trying to balance the ticket out because everybody knows that, you know, old Joe Biden might not even be around that much longer. And of course, under those, if he does pop his clogs or become, you know, incapable, then she takes over. But of course, she's very much from the establishment wing of the Democratic Party, unlike Tulsi Gabbard. And the problem in US politics, as in politics in general in the West, is it's driven by funding and money. And you cannot put
Look
what happened to Jeremy Corbyn.
Is that not here in Britain? Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not just the States, is it? Here too.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, anybody who's coming from left field with limited resources has a huge problem getting elected because there's a massive, you know, well-funded cacophony of people shouting you down and trying all sorts of tricks to shut you up, and you know, we could go on for a long time about all the things that implies.
Yeah, like Keir Starmer appearing, who's you know, he was also a prosecutor we mentioned last week, didn't we? You know, another prosecutor who's been dirtied up with the suppression of the prosecution of Jimmy Savile when he was alive, and also, I mean, in many other cases, but also kicking off the prosecutions against Assange, this sort of thing. Once you've got a dirtied up prosecutor, then it seems that they're getting a kind of conveyor belt into the most powerful positions in the country, which is utterly perverse. But anyway, look, let's have a listen now to this guy, Klaus Schwab. I suppose before we do, Martin, you know, if there was to be a great reset, in other words, the whole economic system collapses, we have chaos around the world in terms of, you know, basically the money system falling apart, where people's purchasing power goes down to zero, and we're all so dependent on this financial system now. I would say deliberately we've been made dependent by taking those basic human rights, things that we all need, water, food, shelter, etc., and making us pay for them, which we shouldn't have to do. There should all be, I mean, that stuff is a free gift to mankind. You know, the idea that you can't build a house for yourself, or that you have to pay for water. Up until very recently in Ireland, it was free. Certainly when I was a kid here in the UK, water was paid as the water rates, and if you were renting a property, it was the landlord that paid for your water, this sort of thing. And that we have been fixed into this financial system. And now the financial system is being like a rug being pulled out from underneath us. So let's have a listen now to this chap, Klaus Schwab. He's at the World Economic Forum, the Davos conference, which happens at the beginning of every year up in the mountains of Switzerland. Presumably so loads of protesters find it difficult to do anything there. That's the obvious reason, isn't it? We've got that snow around. It's extremely difficult to even survive the night somewhere like that. About the Great Reset.
Let's hear from the forum's executive chairman and founder, Professor Klaus Schwab.
Thank you, Adrian. It is obvious that we are in the midst of the most severe crisis the world has experienced since World War II. 75 years ago, countries and people came together to shape the post-war global order, which brought us decades of peace, increased global cooperation and prosperity to hundreds of millions of people around the world. The COVID-19 crisis has shown us that our old systems are not fit anymore for the 21st century. It has laid bare the fundamental lack of social cohesion, fairness, inclusion, and equality. Now is the historical moment, the time, not only to fight severe virus, but to shape the system for the need for the post-corona era. In short, we need a great reset.
Now is the time to think what history would say about this crisis. And now is the time for all of us to define our own role. What is it that would make it so that history would look at this crisis as the great opportunity for reset?
The Great Reset is a welcome recognition that this human tragedy must be a wake-up call. It is imperative that we reimagine, rebuild, redesign, reinvigorate, and rebalance our world. Rebalancing investment, harnessing science and technology, and advancing the transition to net zero emissions, all elements of the Great Reset, are fundamental to building the future we need.
And I'll give you a moment to shake off the creepiness of these people at the World Economic Forum. It's headed up by a guy named Klaus Schwab.
Yeah, so the Great Reset, Martin. I mean, if you were sitting there with your blank piece of paper looking at a global economic system, that is to say, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, the regulation of international banking, what would be your bullet point list for the actual things that these guys should be doing?
Well, the obvious thing is to cooperate sensibly with the leadership in China. Because they are, you know, they are the coming thing. And the Chinese are very unhappy because the whole international system has been geared for 500 years around the needs of the Western powers. And all of this, all of that stuff there about sustainability, inequality, they're coming out with all of this stuff. But we know who they are. They're the ones who benefited from the crisis in 2008 and are waking out like bandits from the crisis we're in now. So the idea that these people are the solution is part of the problem. They see themselves as indispensable, whereas in actual fact, what the Chinese are proposing to do is a Marshall Plan for the developing world. But of course, the West doesn't want a Marshall Plan for the developing world. They want the developing world where it's always been. We were talking about Mali earlier.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is the Chinese have got a global reset Plan B.
Well, they've got their own version of it. I mean, basically, something is going to happen as a result of this crisis that we're in. There's no doubt about it. It's the biggest systemic crisis since World War II. But the most likely thing to come out of it is World War III. I mean, what else does the people expect? And of course, if the Chinese are victorious, and it won't necessarily be a nuclear exchange, it could just go on as a lot of fisticuffs, as we've seen between India and China in Ladakh. Ultimately, there's no reason why the Western powers shouldn't accept a cooperative relationship with them and with the Russians. But they don't want one. They don't want to change what's going on. They want to retain power, and they're using all of this rhetoric about inclusion and environmental concerns as a means of basically staying in power and doing what they want.
Anyway, the author of Killing the Host, Michael Hudson, is one of the greatest analysts on this whole system, and he puts it so clearly, Martin. I find his take absolutely brilliant. The idea, of course, here with this Killing the Host concept is that the financial system is being what they call financialized, so that it's just becoming about money and the actual activity of the economy, businesses, etc., particularly small businesses, the money passing around families, etc., is insignificant. What really matters is various casino gambles that are being done by the multi-billionaires and trillionaires.
Well, as Keynes pointed out in the 1930s, speculation is part of human nature. You know, people are always going to want something for nothing. But it's not really a problem if you've just got some marginal people who are speculating on the margin of the economy. But if they become the economy, I mean, look at the stock markets now all over the world, in the developed world, they're all rising astronomically. You know, they're rising exponentially at the same time as the real economy is collapsing. That can't be right. There's a complete disconnect between the two. And obviously what will happen at a certain point is the financial services sector will collapse down to its real size and overshoot, and that will be the crash, and there won't be any rescuing of anything after that.
Well, there's a great,
and then at that point the war really gets going on a micro level. You know, people are going to be fighting for every barrio, every favela, every township.
So he did a very, very good thing back earlier. In fact, we had a clip from it actually when I was back over in New Zealand, from Michael Hudson's special Lessons for 2020, called Economic Lessons for 2020. So let's have a listen to a little extract from that now, where he talks about how the casino economy is taking over from the real economy and, as he says in his book, killing the host.
American corporate debt has surpassed $10 trillion, which is roughly the equivalent of 47% of the entire economy. Do you think that this could trigger the next crisis? And how would this debt bubble be different from the housing bubble? A little bit going back to this question around the real economy and the financial economy.
Well, $10 trillion may seem a lot, but it really is only twice the cost of the Afghan war. When you get right down to it. Nonetheless, Wall Street is increasingly worried about the corporate junk bonds. With interest rates down to about 1%, there have been a lot of speculators and corporate raiders that borrow very inexpensively to buy companies and take them over. And so you have an enormous amount of corporate debt that's being added by people borrowing from banks to by companies. And also, companies themselves have been borrowing at maybe 1% to buy their stock that's yielding 8 or 9%. After President Trump's tax cuts, for instance, almost all of the money from the tax cuts was spent on tax buybacks. They weren't spent the way that Marx described industrial capitalists is spending their money on building new factories and hiring more labor. People are not making money by hiring labor anymore. They're making money by buying stocks and bonds and having the government artificially support their prices until finally they say it's all over, sell out, there will be a huge crash, the pension funds will all crash, and they're going to leave, they call the weak holders, the pension funds and the non 10%, holding the bag, as it were. So if the economy is shrinking, then obviously the flow of profits, the output is going to be shrinking, unless companies can simply sell less goods, but for much more. And so the Trump administration has followed the Democrats in getting rid of the anti-monopoly legislation and prosecution. They're essentially promoting just rising prices for everything. So the question is, how long can companies get by producing less, charging more, when the customers are poor and poor, and you're not selling to China anymore, or Russia, or even Europe, because they can't trust American suppliers, or they don't want to buy more Boeings, and Trump has wanted them to buy at least a military industrial goods, but they're pushing back on that. So obviously there are a lot of corporations that are going to go the way of Toys R Us, Sears, Roebuck. You see, the retail stores are the first that are going bankrupt. Then you're going to have the heavily leveraged buildings where either the building goes bankrupt or you borrow from the Saudi Arabians, like Trump's family have done. So the housing bubble was very largely fraud, and to answer your question, but the corporate bubble is just plain greed, and finance lives in the short term. They all know that the debts can't be paid. Everybody I talk to on Wall Street knows that there's going to be a crash, but they think they can sell out first because someone from the government and the Fed will call them and say, we're going to raise interest rates suddenly, bail out, and they're all going to bail out and leave the non-insiders holding the bag, or at least they think that they can do that. But this isn't talked about in the press because bad economic news doesn't attract advertisers to the newspapers. And newspapers, their clients are the advertisers, not really the readers. So the newspapers are going to say, yes, the economy's growing, everything's doing fine. And politically, the media worry that if they say, well, we're in an economy that's shrinking and living standards are going to fall, then Wall Street's siphoning off the money, then people are going to turn socialist. Well, obviously, you're not going to have the government economists creating a body of socialists by telling them how the economy really works and what's in store for them all. So that's the problem, cognitive dissonance.
Martin?
That's pretty accurate. What he's very good at is pointing out the difference between productive and unproductive investment, which was actually common sense in the 19th century. Economists like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Karl Marx, they all distinguish between productive and unproductive investment. And what that means is, and of course it's in Keynesianism as well, investment for Keynes is when you actually build a factory and employ people. The word investment in English also means buying stocks and shares. But buying stocks and shares is just creating the resources for somebody else to actually invest.
I mean, he's saying something pretty, I think, fascinating there, which never gets said. I mean, you won't hear Michael Hudson on the BBC, will you? Or CNN on places like this very, very rarely on any networks. In fact, you won't be hearing him on BCFM anymore if their managing editor Pat Hart gets his way. You know, this is an analysis which is just simply not available. As he says, you know, there are all sorts of pressures on people, editors, managers, etc., to not to say these things. But he's making a really, really basic point there, which is all these massive investment companies can borrow money at virtually zero interest rates and then just invest them in stocks and shares, which are going up at whatever, 5, 6, 7, 8%, and actually doing nothing for it. And the reason those stocks and shares are going up and the property prices are going up is simply because of QE. So this is free money being given to the richest of the rich by governments.
Yes, and it's got nothing to do with free market economics. There are genuine free market economists, the Mises Institute people, who think this is disgusting, and they're right. that their delusion, from my point of view, is that there ever was any other kind of capitalism. And of course, some Marxists miss out on this as well, because what Marx did when he was writing is he said, let's not presume that the capitalists are swindlers. Let's just analyze capitalism as if they weren't, as if they genuinely were, you know, building stuff and providing work and so on. Of course, that's not really the case, but just for the sake of argument, because otherwise you'll just say that this is my argument is just saying that they're swindlers. Now, what we've actually got now is swindle capitalism. The people who are in charge of the capitalist system, the ones who are making all the money, are not industrialists of the old school. They don't make anything. They don't build anything.
I mean, do people at Bristol University, Martin, Bristol University and other big universities, do they know this stuff? Because they don't really
seem to. Well, in actual fact, university economics departments are probably one of the last bastions of people who actually know what's going on. But what happens is what Simon Wren-Lewis from Oxford University calls media macro. So you get this very watered down pro-business twaddle in the financial press. You know, you can think about The Economist. We've often snorted about The Economist, but they are absolutely 100% on the side of the moneyed interest.
Well, and, yeah, the other problem
there it's not objective analysis.
We're seeing increasing privatisation and private money influencing and directing the way our university departments operate, including, obviously, economics departments.
That's true. And, of course, after the 2008 crash, there was a bit of a pushback from economics students saying, look, we want to have, you know, a wider curriculum so that we can understand what's happened. And the Queen famously said, you know, why didn't anybody see this coming? Now, in actual fact, people like Michael Hudson had seen it coming a mile off, and so people like myself.
Well, and also we had Norman Dodd, a clip from him a couple of months ago, actually, talking about the Rockefeller Foundation deciding that they were going to recruit what they called a stable of economists and then give them all places at the top universities in the United States in order to push their view of economics and argue it, for example, on national television, and to make sure that their people won the day in the intellectual argument. I mean, it's an incredible idea that you can take over this kind of whole intellectual argument at the universities.
Well, Philip Mironovsky has done a very good study. He's very good on all this about the sociology of cognitive dissonance. I can't remember the name of the book, but it came out after the crisis in 2008, where he pointed out everybody at the time was talking about, we'll have to change our attitude. When, I mean, even people like David Cameron were saying, you know, the banks have really overreached themselves this time. We're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to put them in order. But they managed to actually not only not pay the price for 2008, they made loads of money out of it, and they're making loads of money out of this crisis as well. So from their point of view, it's a win-win scenario.
Well, hang on, you're reminding me now about Rowan Bosworth Davis, the former fraud squad officer from the Metropolitan Police, who was on our show several times. He's still around doing his stuff. And he pointed out to Andrew Tyrie, who was doing the government committee, which was supposed to be reviewing the situation after the 2008 crisis, suggesting ways to divide up the casino banks from the high street banks. And he said basically that the way that the financial regulation and that the city operates is exactly fitting the organized crime definitions of the Europeans, the Brits and other parts of the world.
Well, it's essentially what's called control fraud. If you're in charge of the operation, you can run it for your personal interest. So what happens if, even if you get caught, the institution is fined, but you are not. And even if you were fined, the amount of money you've made through the fraud is more than the money you're going to be fined. Individuals are very rarely fined in any case. And that makes it a moral hazard is then created, whereby if you're a mug if you don't join in with everybody else.
Yeah, and
like Rain Man.
Martin, I'm also reminded of I don't know what I've forgotten now. You mentioned Rain Man.
Yes.
So that was the guy that was done. We actually spoke to his father, didn't we? Who used to be a producer at World in Action about that case. He was fitted up, effectively, and the only reason he was fitted up was because he had in his possession the manual from UBS in Switzerland, which had told them how to fix the LIBOR rate. So he was put in jail for something which he'd actually been instructed to do by his bank bosses.
That's right. And of course, there's no way in a market that is actually rigged in that way that you can behave in a moral fashion. Because if you do, you're going to be driven out by those who don't.
Well, I feel a little bit like that.
That's the reality.
I feel a bit like that with BCFM as well. Anyway, look, we're going to listen now to a guy called Mario Savio. I mean, he did this amazing speech, didn't he, back in the late 50s, I think, or early 60s.
In the early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah. And it was all based around a campus protest in the United States. So this was really about the privatization of U.S. universities. Do you want to say anything about that before we hear from him, Martin?
Well, I think the speech we're about to hear is the famous one he made at the Berkeley free speech protests, where beginning in the early 60s, students at the University of Berkeley in California started to protest against the Vietnam War, and they had what they call free speech, where they had speeches and they handed out leaflets, and they created People's Park, which was a place for public debate of what was going on, and the university authorities tried to close it down, and it led to a bit of a confrontation, which led to the famous Beach Boys song Student Riot.
Anyway, I just it was fascinating that it was all about privatization and the universities. And what they were saying effectively was that, you know, basically we're not animals, we're not sheep. You can't just buy and commodify our minds and our brains and program young people, although that seems to be the way things have gone since. So anyway, let's have a little listen to, I don't think it's him to start with, it's another speaker, but we end up with hearing Mario Savio now.
So here we are. Four students are getting the axe, six organizations are getting the axe for standing up this semester and for fighting for these things. They're getting the axe not for what they did, but for what we have done. They spoke for us, they were part of us, they have been singled out, and they're going to be chopped off.
We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the board of regents are the board of directors, and if President Kerr in fact is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials. But we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
So revolutionary, rousing words, though, there from Mario Savio. Yeah, it is true here now, isn't it? You know, that speech, what we're talking about there, 60 years ago or so, I mean, that is really he's saying, look, students are not commodities, but actually increasingly they are, aren't they? A bit like we were hearing about the newspapers, where the readers are a commodity, really just to be served with comforting news for the sake of the advertisers.
Yeah, well, the second bit of that speech is famous because, of course, it began it was a turning point in the rebellion of educated young people in the US against the Vietnam War. Mario Savio himself was a physicist. He ultimately became a professor of physics. He's dead now. He died not long ago. And that was a very famous moment because suddenly, and of course, the point he was making led to lots of direct action. So, the whole idea that we're not just going to wait for the next election, we're going to start putting ourselves, our bodies, on the gears of the machine so we can stop the machine working. And that had a great deal of influence.
He's talking about civil disobedience. He's saying effectively that just staying within the law is going to try and, corral you. Actually, what you need to do is to decide your own role in society rather than have that legally spelt out for you by a financially influenced and basically a finance system which is dominating the legislation.
Yeah, and of course, everything that they were opposing in the early 60s there in California, we've got it all in on steroids now. And we really are just as badly off as we were then, but worse. I mean, back in the 60s, there was still an attempt to try and create a new society in the United States to try and deal with the problems of poverty and racism. But now there's not even an attempt to deal with the problems. We're just told that we just got to suck it up. And of course, ultimately, that's not. There's going to be a reaction to all of this.
Okay, so anyway, this is documentary time now. And this is in yesterday's iPaper, how MI6 and the CIA overthrew an elected leader. A new documentary reveals the UK's selfish meddling in Iran. An article by Kim Sengupta. It starts off, Iran has a deep mistrust about Britain, dating back to an event that's unlikely to be forgotten or forgiven in the near future. The subject of a new documentary, Coup 53, released tomorrow, that's today, examines the overthrow of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, and his replacement by the Shah of Iran, all instigated by London and Washington, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, people don't know what happened yesterday. So what happened in 1953 seems like, millions of years ago. But it isn't. People in Iran all know that the democratically elected government of their country was overthrown by MI6, the same people that were chummy with the Islamic Fighting Group in the 1980s. And then the SAVAK secret police then brutalised the society with the full support of the Western powers. And of course, it was BP that were behind all of that, as well as the governments in the West. Because Mossadegh basically wanted to nationalise the oil industry and use the resources to build people up instead of all the money ending up in the City of London. And he ended up under house arrest, dying under house arrest. And eventually, of course, there was a revolution in 1979, which has led to the current standoff between the Iranian authorities and the Western powers.
Yeah, so it's all very important stuff. The idea obviously was that you can run this, but we're going to own it, effectively, the oil industry.
Well, what happened was, a bit like the Suez Canal, they took the view that, if you kick us out, you'll never be able to run it, which was wrong. They could, they were going to be paid compensation. We're going to decide the level of compensation. And of course, the Iranians now run their own oil industry with their own technicians perfectly well. They don't necessarily need dimwits from British public schools to show them what to do.
So let's have a listen now to the Channel 4 news report of this, which was on the TV earlier this week, this film out today.
In 1953, the United States, together with Britain, participated in a coup in Iran.
The British were the architects of a coup in a bid to prevent the first ever democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, from renationalizing Iran's massive oil reserves, which at the time were the exclusive reserve of BP. Indeed, they were the origin of the company's wealth. America always admitted its involvement in the coup. Britain never has. Yet the architect of it was MI6 officer Norman Derbyshire. Only a transcript of an interview with him remains. Rafe Fiennes is drafted in to reenact the MI6 officer.
Were you involved in Afshar Tooth's assassination?
Yes. But it was never the intention that Afshar Tooth should be killed. Something went wrong.
Mossadegh was eventually put on trial, but refused to accept his prosecutor's right to try him. Many blame the coup for eventually bringing about Iran's Islamic Revolution 26 years later, in 1979. The director of the film, Coup 53, Taghi Amirani, wants Britain to come clean over its role in a bid in part to help bring closure to the swirling tensions that surround Iran to this day.
The coup for Iranians is a national scar, emotionally and mentally, that hasn't healed. And every time things flare up between Iran, between the West, Britain and America, that scab gets picked again, and things flare up all the time. But to understand the aftermath, to understand everything that's happening to the present day, even right now with UN resolutions and embargoes and threat of war, is rooted in 53. We need to understand that to understand everything else.
The Americans are perfectly proud of their role in that coup, but the British have never spoken about it, never admitted they were there, and yet they were the drivers.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the sole reason I made this film. Get my adopted home, Britain, I've lived here for a long time, I love it, to admit their role. Admit not just their involvement, the fact that they were the masterminds of this, they ran it. We have it now in black and white from the MI6 agent, Norman Derbyshire, who says, I ran the coup, it was my responsibility. I think to come clean about this would be good for everyone.
So the nub of your film is, frankly, that the British did not want to lose British petroleum. Did not want to lose that oil to the Iranian.
Yes, absolutely. There were several reasons. One is you don't want to lose this huge, huge lucrative asset. You know, you want the Iranian oil. That's one thing. The other thing is you don't want to set an example. Mossadegh does this. Nasser would want to nationalize the Suez Canal, which he did exactly. Mossadegh was a huge, huge hero for Nasser. The other thing that they did some crazy things. We think what's happening now is the first time that things are happening. Harry Truman said there is nothing new in the world except the history you do not know. Sanctioning Iranian oil, 53. The British put on an oil embargo on Iran. They put adverts in international papers saying if you buy Iranian oil, you're buying stolen goods. They put fake news in the papers. You think fake news is now? CIA and MI6 invented fake news. A CIA agent in Langley would write propaganda against Mossadegh. He's a homosexual. He's a Jew. He's a communist. He's a fanatic. He's crazy. He's unhinged. That paper would appear in Iranian newspapers the next day.
I've actually been to Mossadegh's house, and he's buried underneath. He's actually buried in the living room.
He is buried under the floor tiles in the dining room. Why? Because the Shah wouldn't allow a public burial for him, because he was worried about Mossadegh's grave becoming a shrine.
They will never apologize. You just want them to admit.
Admitting would be a great step. Get it off your chest. Unburden yourself. Give some respect to the Iranians, have some respect for the dignity. You've scarred this nation for 67 years. It's poisoned and completely destroyed your relationship.
Would it improve current relations?
I think coming clean about something clears the air. I think it'll be a cathartic confession for the Brits. It'll be good for the Iranians to hear it, Iranian people to hear it, and it will pave the way for better understanding. And it's absurd because, you know, everyone knows the Brits were doing this. It's the most absurd open secret.
And the Americans have admitted it.
They always use the Cold War as the excuse. We were saving Iran from communism. BS. This was about Iran's oil. The Americans said, we'll come and help you if you have some of that oil, and they did.
Taghi Amirani, thank you very much for talking to us.
Fascinating, Martin. There's only one thing about history that we don't know, and that's what we don't know. Or that was a very bad version of that quote we just heard. But it's interesting, isn't it? This link with the Suez Crisis too, which people wouldn't probably be aware of at all.
Well, I mean, that's why, for example, in the 1980s, both Nicaragua and Mozambique and Angola were subjected to massive destabilizing terrorist attack by Western intelligence services. You'd have thought they're only minor countries. There's not that much there. I mean, in Angola, there's quite a lot of oil, so that's probably not a good case. But Nicaragua is a poor country. Why do you want to smash Nicaragua to pieces? And the answer is because they're a bad example. If the Nicaraguans get away with having a rebellion against Somoza and bringing in an elected socialist government and start to improve people's living standards, they're all going to want to do it.
Well, you could say the same, actually.
You've got to put stops before it gets
going. You could say the same about Libya, couldn't you, in 2012?
Yeah. I mean, that's why they're not able to tolerate even small countries that are not very powerful.
But this is an absurd level of control freakery. Really, really quite scary.
Well, it's always been that way. It's not as if it's a new thing. And in many ways, the current setup is even more interventionist than it was in those days when we openly invaded Iraq and bombed it back into the Stone Age. You know, Vietnam won their war, but at huge price to the population. And, you know, the thing is that what happens is we get stuff about Belarus or whatever in the news, and people have got a very limited idea of any of the background. And of course, the kind of infotainment news agenda that you get in the mainstream.
Well, and also, explain
the background to people.
And also on BCFM now, unfortunately. Look, what about the Brits and MI6, the Foreign Office? Are they going to apologise?
Well, even if they did, I think the idea...
Will they admit it? Those are the two things, isn't it? Well, will they admit it? Will they apologise?
Well, the British have a tendency not to apologise for anything. You know, they just you know, keep stum about it. Even if they did, it's not going to make that much difference on the ground in Iran, because everybody knows anyway. What might make a difference is with the know-nothing people in Britain who just presume that Britain's just a beacon of freedom and democracy. And, you know, all
that's
these
an
around the world,
you're
we just
on an
around
American
the world
accent.
Helping people.
OK, so let's have a look at our second documentary this week. It's called Plandemic 2. I haven't watched the whole thing, but I did see that it's got a very good section on Google censorship. And it just shows you, never use Google. Only idiots use Google, because anything you're really trying to find nowadays, since they brought this new algorithm in over the last few years, it's going to be buried. It's either not going to be in their search results, or it's going to be deliberately shoved right to the very bottom, hundreds of pages away from anything you're going to find at the top of the search. So it's become a total perversion, Google, of what it was originally. And in fact, they got rid of this this little epithet that the Google had, which is "don't be evil." They even dropped that about 18 months ago. So this is a great clip from the from the new film out this week, Plandemic 2, the movie. It's Plandemic 2, the movie, and this is on Google censorship.
There it is. Only what they want us to see. In today's culture of copy and paste journalism, it's common for hundreds of unrelated outlets to feature the exact same report. This is not the result of laziness. This is by design. When we see identical headlines across seemingly unrelated platforms, the logical mind concludes, well then, it must be true. The illusion that numerous news sources have arrived at the same conclusion gives us confidence to share the chosen narrative. And just like that, we become the unwitting pushers of propaganda. Search engines are the holy grail for those seeking to control the narrative.
Google is already more powerful in terms of its control over people's lives than almost every government on the planet.
As the most influential search engine in the world, through its ubiquitous reach, Google has more power to influence U.S. elections than any foreign nation.
You testified before this committee.
What he goes on to say there is, I mean, I was surprised that it stopped when it did. It should have gone a little bit further than that, actually. But the guy who's being interviewed there is testifying at a congressional committee, and he's explaining just the extent to which Google can increase or decrease the individual candidate in an election's prospects. Or, for example, I mean, you'll see little things when you Google stuff, you'll see a little thing at the top saying advert. Well, what's happened actually now is almost all of the content of the search engine is advertising, because certain of the corporate lines that are being taken, Martin, are being pushed up the search results. Other lines are being pushed down. So the whole thing is turning into a gigantic, great marketing tool.
Yeah, well, of course, the great boast of the Internet was that if you put in a search term, what would come up would be what most other people had looked at, so that therefore you could be confident that when you saw something at the top of a search, it was what most people had seen, and therefore outsiders could get in a word in edgeways. And of course, once they got momentum, they could actually use that to spread their message. But of course, what they've done now is, without telling anybody openly, although they've kind of admitted it, they basically rig the searches to point you in the direction they want you to go, which is no different, really, from, you know, what goes on in the mainstream press all the time. The advertisers decide what's in it, and the readers are very much a secondary matter.
This plandemic thing, I'll put a link up to it on our show page. It comes hot on the heels of Plandemic One, which was interviews with experts criticizing the response to the COVID-19 pandemic, for example, saying that chloroquine was a good treatment, where actually that was then proved that chloroquine has for many, many years been known to be a very good way of treating the SARS virus, which is the various experts are now saying that the COVID-19 has the characteristics of the SARS virus, and therefore it makes quite perfect sense to be treating people with chloroquine, even though Donald Trump was being ridiculed by Channel 4 News and others for considering taking it. So this is the danger of where non-medical experts turn themselves into journalists and use the pandemic to sort of jump on the next bandwagon to bash the people that they normally bash and congratulate the people they normally congratulate. I suppose, you know, news becoming like virtue signaling effectively. But with all this censorship, I was quite surprised to see this censored this week by YouTube. And it is one of my films I put up a few years ago. It's from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Their 60 Minutes documentary series is rather like our World in Action used to be here, which is the toughest of the tough investigative TV documentary. For example, they did a fantastic documentary called Sex, Lies and Julian Assange at the time of the initial Julian Assange case, which showed that really he had no case to answer the case over in Sweden, and that the girls were lying effectively. For example, one of them tweeting saying, "Oh, I had a great night with Julian Assange. What a fantastic time." And then later she decided to go and say that she'd just been raped. Well, I mean, I don't think that you do that, make great tweets about how someone is wonderful if they've just raped you. So those were the sorts of points they're making, 60 Minutes. But this is an old one. This is from 1989, and it is about Satanism in Britain. So the Australians actually came over to the UK and were doing documentaries about satanic ritual abuse here. Now, the context of this, of course, is that the idea that ritual abuse takes place is completely taboo in the mainstream press now. Even places like Private Eye just simply ridicule anybody that says it's taking place. But here we have a young child and other people interviewed by 60 Minutes Australia who most definitely do believe it was taking place. And I would just say, if there's anyone listening who's a youngster or anyone of a sensitive nature, you probably better switch off now. You can always pick this up on the podcast later at thisweek.org.uk. But this is a pretty horrifying account by the documentary program 60 Minutes from ABC Australia about Satanism in Britain.
Few people, if any, in Britain have counseled as many victims of satanic abuse or Satanists themselves as Ray Wire has. If there is an expert on satanic cults, it would have to be him.
Do you believe Teresa's story?
I believe Teresa's story. It's exactly the same story as I've heard from men who says they've done it.
You've dealt with other cases like hers?
Yes.
21 cases like hers, he says, in the past 2 years alone.
Themes like they were put in boxes with spiders and worms, where they were trapped in fear, where there was a high use of excrement and urine, where there was talk of human sacrifice.
Take just one of those rituals, putting children in boxes with spiders and worms. Now, listen to what Teresa told her mother.
And they had a coffin-like box that children were put in with spiders and snakes, and the lid shut. And left in there, I would have come out deranged. I could not have coped with that mentally at all.
You have evidence to back up stories like Teresa's, that this is really happening?
Well, we have that age of child, 6, 5, and 4, giving information that ties up with Teresa. How do those children know? How do those children able to describe rituals, to talk about ceremonies, to talk about sacrificing animals? How do those children know?
Nightmares, imagining it?
You can't imagine those things at 3 and 4 years old, and you also don't have the evidence of anal sex abuse and oral sex abuse and all that other abuse that clearly those children have experienced and endured.
During these ceremonies, was Satan, the devil, ever referred to?
He was called Lucifer.
What did they say about the devil, about Lucifer?
Killing the people made him happy.
Sacrifices to please the devil. According to Teresa, the worst rituals took place at a house somewhere in the country.
It was big, you know, expensive. From the front, it looked like a castle. You know, it had a long drive and big double wooden doors.
Do you think they were rich people then?
Very rich.
Now, where was this big house somewhere in the country? Teresa says she can't take the police there because the Satanists made sure she'd never know how to find it.
Teresa was always drugged, or on a couple of occasions she says she was knocked out, so she never fully knew the route. There was a tramp who was brought in once, you know, and he was killed. He was cut from his throat down to his stomach. And they ate him, or bits of him.
They killed a man at a ceremony?
Yeah.
In front of you?
Yeah, in front of all of us.
Did the tramp, did this man fight back?
No, I think he was, you know, drunk or something. He seemed really dopey. He was laughing a lot when he was brought in. And he started screaming when they began to cut. But after a while, you know, he died. I'd seen a few killings before then. Well, I wasn't used to it. It, you know, that was the worst one. I really don't know what I thought. I suppose I thought, thank God it's not me.
Let me get this right now. Are you saying that you saw more than one person killed in that house?
Yeah. I've seen loads of babies killed there. Just newborn babies. Or aborted ones, which were only small. Four-year-olds. Any age, really.
Did they ever say they might kill you?
They threatened to kill my little girl, who, when I left, was still at the house.
A friend?
Huh?
What little girl?
My little girl, Alex. She's about 4 now.
You mean you had a child?
Yeah.
How old were you when you had that child?
11.
Mm. Motherhood at the age of 11. But from what Teresa told her mother, it wasn't the only pregnancy.
We think that's 7 or 8 times. It's hard to say. It was constantly happening from the time she was capable of being pregnant.
What happened to the pregnancies, to the babies?
They were aborted by my nan or by one of the doctors at the house.
There were doctors there at that house?
Yeah, there was 2, I think. Yeah, and a nurse.
What would happen to the fetuses, the unborn babies?
They used to be taken away most of the time, and one time baby was taken out of me and then killed in front of me because it was still alive.
And then what would happen?
Well, after they killed it, they would eat it. Well, we were also made to eat it.
You were made to eat your own fetus?
Yeah.
Who made you do this?
My nan.
You'd think the one person in the world you could leave a little girl with would be Grandma. Someone to give her love and protect her from harm. Yet, when Teresa was left to live with her grandmother, they might as well have handed her to the devil himself.
Grandmothers, I mean, the vision, it conjures up for you. A sweet old lady, grey hair, rosy cheeks, holding her arms out to love her grandchildren. And it was exactly the reverse.
But why was Teresa living with Nan in the first place and not with her mother?
Well, when my first marriage broke up, I took the children with me and couldn't cope. So I gave them to their father, who in turn moved to his mother's.
To Nan's place?
Yeah. And when he left the Nan's place, he left the children there.
How do you feel now towards her grandma and the other people who did all those things to your daughter?
They disgust me. They are the worst form of life this earth has had the misfortune to create. Vile.
Did you ever try to run away? You must have been frightened.
A couple of times I did, but my uncle, he caught me and brought me back.
Going to the police? Did that occur to you?
No. No. I thought it was normal, you know, even though I didn't like it. You know, I mean, you don't like to eat greens, but I thought it was just her being called to be kind or something like that.
She said to me it was something that everybody did, she thought, you know. Like, you don't like going to school or the dentist. You don't like going to the black masses.
It was never any different. I didn't have nothing to compare it to.
All part of life, Teresa thought. Even a miscarriage one day at school.
Yeah, I asked the teacher if I could go to the toilet, and she allowed me out. I went into the toilet and the baby was in my knickers. I thought it was dead, but it wasn't. It was still moving.
And yet no one at school knew?
No.
Saw anything?
No. Or if they did, they didn't say. No, she was treated for a high temperature, a fever, nothing more.
What did she do with the baby?
She kept her for a while because she was frightened that they'd use the child as part of the rituals. So she turned the pencil case into a little coffin. Apparently she put roses in to make her smell sweet. Put a letter with her, pictures of herself and her brother, a picture of me.
And then I put it down the chute because I didn't want my nan to get it.
As we said earlier, the police have already charged some members of the cult, and we know they're also investigating Teresa's accounts of those ritual killings. If there were as many as she told us, then the Satanists had a problem. How did they get rid of the bodies?
They had a tub, you know, pretty big, I don't know. A fairly big tub, and they used to put the bodies and bones in there. And it used to go like, you know, fizzy in it. And then there was nothing left. Or there didn't seem to be, but when they cleared it out, there used to be a sludge at the bottom.
Teresa's story, her account, doesn't really surprise you.
It doesn't surprise me in the light of satanic abuse, no.
Do you get frustrated with people who just won't accept that these things do happen?
Yes, because I've worked with murderers in prisons for years. Not that long ago, a boy was found in a forest in southern England without a head. We have no doubts that men can do that. And yet, when we start talking about men within Satanism, who actually believe in evil and it's the right to express evil, we suddenly have a doubt.
the right to express evil. And that is Google, good old YouTube, removing that from my YouTube channel this week. Interesting to see whose side they're on. I mean, this is a mainstream documentary, Martin, from 1989. This sort of thing was considered normal and obviously with a few caveats suitable for national broadcast by investigative journalists back in the 1980s.
Yeah, I think that's what the most strikes me most about this, is that this is an ABC documentary by mainstream journalists, yet Google have seen fit to take it down.
And I mean,
it's
the other thing
got
is, it's
distressing content,
isn't it?
But yeah, that's not really the point, is it?
No. Well, it's, you know, it's also interesting, I think, that it was ABC came over to the UK to interview Teresa and do their investigation here. You know, there is obviously going to be political pressure on any TV network in their own country not to uncover organised crime in that country if organised crime has got its tentacles into business and television.
Yeah, well, I mean, the King Cora Boys Home scandal was where MI5 were basically prostituting young boys for political purposes in Northern Ireland, and it's well known across the political spectrum what went on there. And but no, you know, you know, the police have been investigating it for years. But I don't know what happened in that particular case. I don't know what political connections these people would have had, but the way she's talking about it, it sounds as if they're wealthy and so on. But I mean, coming back to the issue of censorship, what right do Google have to take down an ABC documentary from 1989? People may agree or disagree with the content, but surely there's no reason why that should be removed.
Well, you wouldn't think so. Yeah, I mean, what they've said is that there's some company that owns some rights in it. So anyway, I'll be fighting that and seeing if I can get it back up online. And I'll also put up a link on our show page to that documentary on another platform, obviously not YouTube. I mean, what do you make of the whole idea of ritual abuse and Satanism, Martin? Do you believe in it or not?
I don't know, Tony. There's plenty of weird people out there who've got lots of weird ideas, you know. And of course, we know that the intelligence services use all sorts of mechanisms for blackmail, including prostituting young children as a means of blackmailing people that they want to blackmail. We know they do that. And of course, once you're and we know that they carry out false flag attacks. We know they carry out assassinations. We heard the MI6 guy earlier saying, yes, we killed this guy. Now, what people have got to realise is that that is the real world. That goes on. And, you know, the idea that it doesn't go on. And you've got to be careful because, of course, there are false allegations and all sorts. But nevertheless, the idea that these things don't happen is for the birds.
I mean,
you can see
a kind of perverted spiritual purpose in this black mass ritual. And that is to sort of basically dirty people up so they feel that they can go and do these things out in the wider world.
Yeah, well, it may be that they're genuine Satanists who generally believe in Satanism, or maybe what they're really doing is they're creating a blackmailable clientele. Yeah, the people who are coming in to participate in all of this may be senior people in politics and business, and that's the purpose of it.
Well, maybe,
and of course, in any case, you use a psychological torture like this uses all kinds of techniques.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, Martin, it's just a death cult like the Skull and Bones. Anyway. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Sunday evenings at 6 with Danny Lotch on BCFM, always worth a listen. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream, 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.